Welcome back, everybody, to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and today's guest is Dr. Garvin Walsh, a former international security policy advisor who now runs Brexit Analytics, a consultancy set up to help business navigate the choppy waters of Brexit. In this interview, we cover a wide range of issues, and despite Garvin being a columnist for Conservative Home, the Tory blog for grassroots members, he's very candid about the flaws in the government's handling of Brexit. We chat immigration, Euratom, and even how we're in danger of making the same political mistakes as we made in the Iraq War. Hope you enjoy and can take something from the show. Please let us know your thoughts on Twitter, Facebook, or through the website brexitpodcast.com. Now, on to the interview. Garvin, there's an image on the homepage of Brexit Analytics that shows a man in the mountains preparing to leap into the abyss. And this is, you're the founder of Brexit Analytics, of course, and the tagline is "Shape Brexit before Brexit shapes you." Can you give me some background as to what you do these days?
Yeah, so what we do is we advise, you know, companies and do some political work as well on how to get through the Brexit negotiations, how to think about how to cope with them, and also how to try and shape the outcome so that it's a bit more sensible, a little bit less cliff edge like, and it would be beyond our graphic design skills to, you know, imagine a bridge going across that cliff. But what we want to do is be able to create that kind of process.
Okay, so if you and I were stuck in a lift and I'm scratching my head and I got my head in my hands about my company and the fate of Brexit, you've got just 30 seconds to try and give me some support there. What would you say to me?
Well, it really does depend on the company. There's no general answer other than to say what we need now is a transition, because we can't have a swift and sharp fall to the bottom of the cliff. And I think we need much more time to negotiate a sensible relationship with the European Union.
Okay, and as a company owner, I might say, well, there's nothing I can do about that. That's all down to the politicians and those, and David Davis and all of those in charge. So what do I do?
What you can do is you can talk to the politicians. You can particularly talk to your local MP, get them to hear directly from you what how Brexit might be affecting your business. They need that kind of input. They need to get things directly from people that isn't filtered through the media or the briefing that the party headquarters are telling them. And if you go and talk to them directly and set out your case, they will listen.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a bit of positive message then, at least. Yeah. Some action we can take.
And also now, when we've got a very hung parliament, the people in parliament, the MPs, are much more important than they were when the government had a majority. Mm-hmm. Now every MP is suddenly incredibly powerful, and you can really make your voice heard.
Okay, let's change tack slightly. As a former national international policy advisor to the Conservative Party, what were the lessons you learned from that role? And are we more secure if we take Brexit? We'll be better off staying within the EU?
I think, as the Prime Minister said before the referendum was held, we would be much more secure in the European Union. It allows us to share information about terrorists. It allows us to share information about dealing with organised crime. It provides a forum to cooperate diplomatically with our European partners. And with the kind of hard Brexit that the government are pursuing now, all that is at risk.
So if the Prime Minister said that that's what we desperately need as a company, why are we pursuing a hard Brexit in that?
We're going to have to ask the Prime Minister. I think she takes a view that the referendum meant that we had to have control of immigration and had to reduce immigration. And because she's taken that as the overriding priority, it means that a lot of the flexible ways of reaching an accommodation with the EU have been ruled out. I think they need to be ruled back in.
And from your point of view, would you say that immigration is more important than national security?
No. I think national security is obviously the most important thing. The second most important thing is then having a successful economy.
Yeah.
And we need to work out how we deal with all other policies, including immigration, within that framework and on that basis.
I think most listeners would agree with you. So if you know you can join up the dots and they can, why is our Prime Minister not doing this at the moment?
I think there was a mood, and it was very strong before the election, where people decided that what the referendum meant was an instruction from the public to reduce immigration at all costs. That mood existed in the political world and in the Westminster bubble. It wasn't reflected in opinion polling, where people said, yeah, we want less immigration, but they also said, we don't want to pay for it. And I think one of these things that happens when you ask people questions in opinion polls about do they like something, they say, sure, they do. They don't think when they're answering those kind of questions about balancing different forms, different policies off against each other. They'll often give entirely contradictory answers. It's not because they're stupid. It's because they don't think they're being asked to balance things up. When they are asked to balance things up, they balance things up, as they did at the election, where they said, well, we don't really think that the government's plan is a terribly good idea, so we haven't given them a majority. We don't think the Labour Party's plan is a terribly good idea either, on the other hand, so we're not giving them a majority either. The electorate looked at the things on offer and kind of said, meh.
The electorate said, man. It does break. I was going to bring him on to this later on, but I think let's address it now. Talking about the free movement of EU citizens and the settled status deal that's been offered. We've talked about it quite a bit on the podcast.
Yeah.
It's come into for some, in the last week particularly, it's coming from severe flack by the European Union, Guy Verhofstadt and the like, saying it's just completely and utterly unacceptable. I suppose there are a couple of things. It feels like negotiations can't even get moving before we get some kind of agreement in place for this. And then perhaps also that in terms of a labour shortage in the country, then that's potentially going to be an issue. I know food manufacturers are up in arms about the fact that just simply the crops are going to be left to rack and ruin. There is no one there to, you know, in that one particular instance. I'm sure there are many other examples as well. How do you see that situation now?
Well, food manufacturers are up in arms, pubs are up in arms, universities are up in arms.
Have you saw a really, really, really cliched example with the food manufacturers and picking crops?
But
in the field,
it goes across yeah. the whole economy, and the reason is the labour force is shrinking. And what we were really good at doing in the last 30 or 40 years was creating jobs. And we created so many jobs that people came over here to fill them. Unemployment's at, 4 or 5%. It's very, very low. A lot of the people who are unemployed are people who've had very difficult lives, suffer from severe social problems, educational difficulties. Getting them into work is not a simple matter. People have been trying for a long time. Companies can't just take these and expect them to become productive workers straight away. In many cases, they may not be able to retrain them adequately for the skills they need. And in that context, the Prime Minister and one previously, which was Home Secretary's focus on trying to reduce immigration numbers was very, very short-sighted. I think the government made a very... government and the previous government, even going back to Gordon Brown's government, made a very serious mistake in trying to deal with public concern over immigration. Instead of saying, yes, we recognise that there are changes that you're experiencing, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that public services can cope with changes in population. Instead of saying that, they said, well, yes, you're right, what you say is a problem, we're going to reduce it.
Hmm.
And they said that without explaining to people that the costs of reducing it were very, very high, because they included, first of all, leaving the European Union, secondly, putting a number of our universities at risk of bankruptcy, and thirdly, even creating a labour shortage and preventing companies being able to operate, and so putting British jobs at risk by not giving immigrants jobs.
Yeah, I think we had Paul Goldsmith on the show, who's recently written a book on Brexit, and effectively looked at why Britain never really bought into the idea of the EU. And I remember when he made one point when we were talking about Labour and immigrants coming into the country, and somebody put the argument to say that was, GDP is going up, everything is better, and in a localised area such as Boston, the response would be, well, that's your GDP, mate, not mine, I am being swamped.
Boston's been a really interesting example, and the MP there is Matt Warman, has done really interesting work, like bringing the community together and helping it cope with, sounds too negative, but helping it, exist amid this significant rise in Eastern European immigration. And because on the one hand, it does mean that, house prices have gone up, which is itself a dual-edged sword, but there are far fewer empty shops now on the high street than there used to be. There were initially some pressures on schools, but they've been able to deal with them because the government's diverted more funding. So it's about really practically dealing with dealing with any problems at source, rather than reaching for these huge kind of metaphysical political solutions, saying, let's leave the whole European Union, which is going to cost us far more than the money we need to address any localized effects.
sure.
of immigration changes.
Sledgehammer to crack.
Because you see that thing. You see that if in places where there's most immigration, which is actually London, Manchester, Glasgow, people are pretty happy with it. What's happened is there are places that weren't necessarily used to immigration that suddenly experienced quite quick changes in their own population.
Yeah.
And those people were got quite concerned. They weren't used to it, whereas people in the big cities were perfectly used to it. A lot of them were immigrants themselves and saw this as just part of the natural order of things. But people in Boston were surprised. In fact, Boston actually previously had lots of immigration from Ireland. Before that, it had immigration, if you want to call it that, from the rest of England and from Wales, because they always needed people for their meatpacking industry. And they're now a European hub for the meatpacking industry, and that means you need a lot more meatpackers than you.
Sounds like Boston's the blueprint.
I think Boston is the blueprint. If more people were like Matt Warman and less like Nigel Farage, we'd be able to... we'd be in a much more constructive place.
Yes, yeah, we should get him on the show. So the settled status, is that the solution?
I don't think it's quite the solution. There is a lot of suspicion across Europe of British policy on immigration. It's been suspicion that has been fueled by the government's negotiating stance, by ministers talking about them as bargaining chips, and as a result it's put people's backs up. What they really want assurance of is that the status won't change because a new majority gets into the British Parliament and decides to change things. And that's really difficult for Britain to give, because parliamentary sovereignty is so important here. So they want some kind of treaty obligation enforceable by a body they trust to guarantee that these people will be able to stay and continue their lives, that they had moved here on the basis of a certain legal order, and they expect that legal order to continue.
Mm.
And the members of the European Parliament have their own constituents to think about.
So how do you see it playing out?
That's a bit of a game of chicken, because they're... Because in the end, you know, no deal at all, which they could vote a deal down, but that's not going to be very good for their constituents either. So although it's going to be worse for Britain, it's not brilliant for the Poles and the Italians and the Germans who are all living here, who would then be totally at the whim of a British Parliament. Whereas if they can get some sort of agreement,
I just think
the British government's offer didn't go far enough. And also didn't acknowledge that it was actually a response to what the EU had offered a few weeks beforehand.
Mm. But and the clock's ticking, though. Article 50 has been invoked. You know, we have the 2 years, so we ought to get a shift on it.
We have a lot less than 2 years. Yeah, we need to... and that's why I think we need a transition. And we need to have a a longer-term interim agreement that allows us to work this out properly in a way that can command the support of at least, you know, two-thirds or four-fifths of the public, maybe too much. But
yeah. You wrote a piece for Conservative Home recently on this time-limited Brexit transition where you say that attempting to find a status deal by April 2019 would be folly.
Yes, it would be impossible. There's no way we're going to get agreement on all the immense details. You're seeing the controversy at the moment with Euratom, which... the legal position seems to be that we can't actually not leave now that because it was rolled into the Article 50 negotiation notification. But we still need ways to keep our nuclear industry going. Everyone recognises that that's sensible. But all the details will obviously have to depend on what the final status of Britain is. Britain doesn't know what it wants.
Yeah.
So it should be much better to have an interim deal, you know, 5 or 10 years, so that we can work all this out fully and properly.
I talked a little about Euratom on the Tuesdays when we did a weekly news roundup and the situation, and it does feel like it was put into the Article 50 as though we have to leave, and now nobody wants to leave, and everyone is saying it's actually quite a disaster, and in fact, we can leave the European Union. And it's the two are independent anyway.
They're not quite independent. It seems that it's been folded into the European Union treaties. So you need a separate agreement to say that, like Switzerland, we can continue as an associate state, and Euratom will continue to regulate our nuclear industry.
Can you explain why it's so important, if anyone doesn't know?
It's got to do with continuation of nuclear fuel. So we have nuclear power stations, we have radioisotopes for cancer treatment. Nuclear material is used in all kinds of industrial processes, and they wouldn't be able to continue. It would be an international outlaw.
Yeah, and so we can move material backward and forward.
Legally operate these nuclear facilities.
Sure.
We've signed up to a whole set of international nuclear non-proliferation regimes, and that means we have to continue to abide by those. You know, we're not Iran who's trying to get around them.
Mm. And I suppose also from investment, it's a sector that needs huge investment. No one's going to invest if they don't know that you're going to be a part of it.
I mean, I suppose if they cancelled Hinkley Point, that would probably be a pleasant side effect of leaving Euratom.
You're not a fan of Hinkley Point,
clearly. I'm not, no. It's pointlessly expensive.
Okay. Now, I know I'm sort of jumping to and fro. There's many things that I wanted to speak to you about. The one reason I wanted to get you on the show originally was because I read an essay you wrote on how the government was making the same mistakes on Brexit that it made in Iraq.
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, there are five.
Okay.
So the first one is all this stuff about we've had enough of experts. When people said... It said the same things about the Iraq war. You know, we're going to dismiss all these seasoned diplomats who are saying this is very difficult. We're going to dismiss people saying there might be an insurgency. And this isn't to say that you shouldn't go ahead with the Iraq war. I actually supported the Iraq war, but you should then take what the experts say into account and find ways to address the problems the experts come up with. So when Brexit experts say, you know what, trade is going to be very, very difficult. It's a very complicated thing to work out customs procedures if you leave the customs union, or that the EU won't necessarily have a cake and eat it deal. Then you need to listen to that, and you need to work out what your policy should be to respond to it. They didn't do that. They just dismissed them and went ahead with it, and now they've got egg on their face because the whole negotiating process has been a series of failures. They started by saying they would... not invoke Article 50 first, and the EU said we won't negotiate until you invoke Article 50, so they caved in on that. They then said they would negotiate everything simultaneously, and the EU said, well, no, we've got we want to focus on citizens' rights in Northern Ireland and one other aspect that escapes me now. And in the end, the UK government caved in on that. So they haven't done their homework properly. And they haven't listened to the people who do know what they're talking about. It doesn't mean you have to agree with their outcome, but it does mean that you have to accept that the difficulties they point to are real and work out ways around them. In Iraq, they eventually, when General Petraeus came in with his surge, he devised a strategy that depended on listening to what military and state-building experts had said and finding ways to deal with the problems that were pretty evident by then. And so he was able to beat the insurgency back. He was able to start reconstruction of the Iraqi state. Unfortunately, that policy wasn't continued by the Obama administration, but it was starting to have real successes.
Were you in Iraq?
I have been to it, but I wasn't there.
Yeah, there was one point that you made in the piece actually that stuck with me was that when the statue of Saddam was pulled down, there actually wasn't that many people there.
No,
which I thought
there was very few, and the American they couldn't put it down themselves. The Americans had to get a truck with a crane attached.
Yeah,
and it was a sort of metaphor for the whole thing. But the second reason actually. Comes on quite nicely, and that was about believing your own propaganda. So in Iraq, it was believing that the Iraqi people would all rise up against Saddam, and they'd topple his statues like people had done in Eastern Europe. And they didn't, because they'd risen up before when there was an American military intervention in 1991, and then the Americans abandoned them, so they weren't sure they were going to be left at Saddam's mercy a second time. And in this case, you know, there's lots of Brexiteer propaganda about the EU being doomed to fail, about us being shackled to a corpse. And that's not true. I mean, they just clearly hadn't been into continental Europe. They imagined the whole place was Greece, and it isn't. And now we're seeing Eurozone growth that's higher than British growth. Plenty of countries that have low unemployment in the Eurozone. They also forget that, you know, the UK had been a member of the EU for 40 years, and that might have something to do with British economic success. There isn't a contrast between a successful Britain and a failing EU.
Mm-hmm.
And because they did that, they aren't equipped to deal with the difficulties, and they aren't equipped to deal with the much stronger negotiating position that the EU thinks it has. So they thought the EU would cave because it was about to fail and because it was weak. I had the most extreme example of this, which I obviously didn't write about in the essay because it was written almost a year ago, was when people were hoping that Marine Le Pen would win. I mean, it's utterly disgraceful to hope for a fascist to take over in France, and very, very dangerous to hope for a fascist to take over in France. But people had got themselves into a mindset where the bigger collapse you have in the EU, the better it is for Britain, and that was completely wrong. The third reason it's like Iraq is a little bit more subtle. It's because the operation in Iraq got distorted by the obsession with finding weapons of mass destruction. So instead of focusing on rebuilding the state and making sure that people were secure and had jobs and had a future in the new Iraq, a lot of effort was diverted into trying to see whether the WMDs could be found. Because that was the reason they used to justify it.
Yeah.
And this is where immigration comes in, because immigration was used as a tactic and was probably necessary for them to be used as a tactic in order to win, because it was one of the few things that resonated with sections of the public. But once you made immigration reduction the focus of it, it completely messed up your negotiations, because the EU suddenly felt attacked. The Citizens of Nowhere speech was an absolute disaster, particularly when one of your main negotiating partners is Germany.
Mm-hmm. That was Theresa May say you're a world citizen, you're a citizen nowhere at all.
Yeah. You know, it had, talking about a cosmopolitan elite, this had resonances from earlier decades. Mm-hmm. And these kind of things just completely distort what you're trying to achieve. So what you should be trying to achieve if you want a Brexit is a way to have a relationship with the EU that continues to make sense for both Britain and the EU. We're not trying to be hostile to the EU. None of the leading Brexiteers, well, most of the leading Brexiteers, to be fair, didn't want to destroy the EU. They wanted to save Britain, in their view. Mm. And they wanted Britain to be close to and have friendly relations with its continent.
It's something we talked about with negotiating tactics previously, is that the idea that from a negotiating tactics, it seems quite a blunt way of looking at it, that you should start from your most extreme position and then just slowly come back towards the middle. But what that does negate is the fact if you start all the way over here, you just alienate the people you're trying to negotiate with in the first place.
I mean, they also mischaracterized the type of negotiation. They thought it was, you know, like a one-off property deal, but it's not. It's about working out the terms of a new relationship.
Yeah.
It's both very long and detailed, and there's going to be a lot of give and take in the process.
Yeah.
And also there's...
Very much like a divorce.
It's like a divorce.
It's going to be quick and easy.
And it's also like a divorce, because if you don't get the relationship right, you're still stuck with them.
Yeah.
And
myriads of children and property.
We're still stuck with, you know, a whole myriad of commercial and political relationships with European countries. We're still in NATO.
Mm.
We're still in all kinds of international institutions. We still have British companies invested in the EU and European companies invested here. We have families, we've got literal marriages between Europeans and Brits. All these things continue. And it's very irresponsible then to say issue veiled threats like if we don't get a trade deal, we may not be able to cooperate with you in counterterrorism.
Mm.
Which was also very short-sighted, as we found out that a number of the attackers at London Bridge. One had come over most recently from Italy, the other one from Ireland.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the other side, Britain has its own jihadi extremists that also go across borders. And you need to cooperate with countries close by to make sure you catch these people.
Yeah, that would seem sensible. I think trying to legislate or even trying to understand individual radicalised characters who come from Ireland or Italy is perhaps...
I mean, all these people had British connections as well.
Of course.
I'm just making the point here that they're people travel across Europe all the time.
Yes.
And yes, you do look at their passports and see whether, actually, Ireland looks at Brits' passports going to Ireland. Britain doesn't do it the other way around. There isn't even a check.
Just saying, maybe go slightly off topic. So is that through our formula?
That's
one
three.
More point.
That's
we've got
two more.
We've got two more points.
Yeah, the other one is that forgetting that your reputation among foreigners is important to foreign policy. This is a foreign policy test.
Right, yeah.
So pissing them off doesn't work. Just alienate them. It just puts their back up. If you leave the EU on the basis that we don't like your people coming here, you're going to have very difficult negotiations. If you say that you are going to threaten to walk away rather than try and reach a constructive solution, they're going to think less of you. They're going to, at best, think you've taken leave of your senses, and at worst, think you're hostile.
Hmm. Do you think this was after the sort of day after the referendum when people were feeling so overwhelmed and despondent about our nation as a whole from the Remain side that this was the... That was why, that was a prevailing kind of emotion.
I think this was a deliberate decision by the Prime Minister, and I think it had two sources. One was her desire to bring down immigration, which is something she believes in separately, and the other one was her desire to leave the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. And she did those both on principle but also politically, because she looked at a Labour Party in chaos and thought that she could mop up UKIP and thereby cement an enduring Tory majority. It turned out that gamble didn't work, but that was the kind of strategy. You bring those people into the Tory fold by adopting a fairly hardline position, a very hardline position, and then you think that the centrists have nowhere to go because Corbyn is himself such an extremist. But they failed to do that, but that was the strategy. But the effect of that domestically focused political strategy was to make the negotiations much more adversarial than they needed to be.
Mm.
It also alienated Scotland, which, despite the SNP's poor performance at the last election, will continue to be a serious problem.
Mm.
And threatens the integrity of the United Kingdom. And I have one more point.
One more point, and then I'll come back to something
that,
you just said there.
Yeah, which is that shock and awe isn't enough. You need a serious plan. And they don't have a serious plan. I mean, there's the extraordinary thing either yesterday or today where Boris Johnson said there was no plan for no deal, and Davis saying there was a plan for no deal. And even to the extent that there is a plan, they just said there were 100 pages. 100 pages after 7 months' work, simply not acceptable.
No.
And there are huge and detailed... things that have to be worked out. The FT said there were 768 treaties that Britain has to
disentangle itself from.
Yeah,
but you do think that Brexit U-turn, what Vince Cable would like, would be a mistake?
I think it would be a mistake because the people are evenly divided on this. There's no sense going from a country that's slightly in favour of staying in to one that's slightly in favour of staying out. In practice, Britain was about, 60% in the whole structure of European cooperation. And if that changes, so it's 50% in or 45% in, that's something we should see as on a continuum. And I think we can get...
Where do you get that 60% in figure from?
It's a finger in the air, but, right. We're in NATO, we're in... European Patent Courts. We have close relationships over various things, but we were never on the 40% side. On the 60% side, we were never in the Eurozone. We had opt-outs on various other activities. Britain was always pretty ambiguous about the European project. It was more something that we joined because we felt we didn't want to be left out of than something that we were enthusiastic about in the main.
Mm.
And that's been true since the very early stages of European integration back in the 1940s. We just don't feel entirely European. And even, Switzerland in some ways feels more European, though it's not technically in the EU. It's in Schengen. Britain's not in Schengen.
Mm. So if we did go for a complete U-turn, it would be sort of out of the fireplace into the
Yeah, we'd have the same instability for another 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
I don't think our European partners would particularly thank us for it.
No, and because they would probably be in a worse position than going back in than what we are now.
I suspect so.
But rebate, for example,
that is quite possible. Yeah. And I think quite reasonably, you know, going back to the divorce analogy, if we say we want to get back together, they'd want to know we actually meant it.
Yes.
Rather than parliamentary arithmetic or political arithmetic being such that there's a tiny, tiny majority in favour of going back in. I don't think that would be good for business. I don't think that would be good for the sanity of the country. I don't think it would be good for the EU either.
And just finally, and thanks for being so candid today. You know, you write a column for Conservative Home, but you've been quite critical of the government and Theresa May. And do you think the Conservative Party has got a problem at the moment in terms of its perception?
I would hardly be the only person to say that we've got a problem. You know, what in this last election, we tried the same strategy we did in 2005. Of essentially appealing to socially conservative working class voters in the Midlands and the North. Against Tony Blair, we were trounced. Against Jeremy Corbyn, we didn't even manage to win a majority. And it shows that there's always been a tendency among the right of the party to try that, because it means they don't have to worry about liberal Tories like me.
Right.
But yeah. The country doesn't...
Even if they don't believe in it, yeah. Really, is that what
Well, no, some of them do believe in it. I mean, they believe in a socially conservative vision for the country. They want less immigration. They probably want more protectionism. But the centre of the British public doesn't want that. They want to believe that we're an open country. Yes, they want controls on who's coming in and going out of the country, but they don't actually have negative feelings towards immigrants they know. They want to be sure that foreign takeovers happen fairly, but they're not against foreign investment. And we saw in this last election a huge loss of support for the Tories, not just among the young, which often happens, but among 25 to 45-year-olds. Our support went down by about 30%. Among professionals, our support went down by a similar amount. These are the people who should be the backbone. You know, these are the future managers and chief executives of companies and senior civil servants and head teachers that traditionally have always had a decent representation in the Conservative Party. And these are people already saying, you know what, this agenda isn't for us. And we're willing to lend our votes to an extremist Labour Party in order to prevent you getting a majority, because we're very worried about Tory extremism.
So you feel what, Theresa May will stick out Brexit and then there'll be all change, or a general election before that, or who knows?
I'm not going to make any predictions about the future Tory leadership, because I'm sure they'll be completely wrong, whatever they are.
Gavin, thanks ever so much for joining us today on the Brexit podcast.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's all we've got for you today, folks. Let us know your thoughts on Twitter and Facebook and at the website brexitpodcast.com. And if you got the chance to leave us a review on iTunes, then we'd be forever grateful to you. The Brexit Podcast is brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jen Hahn and Warren Pohl, and the theme music is by Kevin MacLeod.